this year's UAW Local 72, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Commemorative Program. Oddly enough, the newly elected Democratic governor was the second choice to give the keynote address. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes was the first choice, but a Local 72 representative told the Kenosha News his schedule became overbooked. The celebration will be held at the union's headquarters on Washington Road in Kenosha on Saturday, January 26 at 5:30 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $10 for kids 12 and under. Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. The NBA last night, Bucks and Bulls were off. Tonight, the Bucks host Miami up at the Fiserv Forum. The Bulls meet the Lakers in Los Angeles. In the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to New Jersey last night 8-5. They're off tonight. College basketball last night, Maryland beat the Badgers 64-60. Tonight, Marquette meets Georgetown. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, January 15th. A cloudy and seasonal day today, a high of 33. Right now, wind southwest at 7. It's an overcast sky, 27 degrees in Racine, 25 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We will be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about nothing less than the future of our planet and how our planet can most effectively confront the challenges of climate change. The book at hand is titled A Bright Future: How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. It is the contention of the co-authors of this book, Stefan Quist, and my guest today, Joshua S. Goldstein, that there is a solution to the most pressing issues involved in climate change, and they are wrapped up in nuclear energy. But this is a form of energy that we do not fully understand and appreciate, and it is the contention of our authors that we often let, in a sense, the wrong kind of fears and concerns rule the day. And we end up making decisions about nuclear power and its efficacy with our gut, responding too much to fears that are often irrationally based. And they implore us to think about this with more clarity, anchored in true science, and also anchored in a real understanding of the enormous peril that our planet faces from the consequences of climate change. And often those consequences, for as much as they get talked about, do not get explained in full clarity in terms of the dimensions of the problem and what we face as a planet. And when we factor in those risks and understand them properly, then the equation starts to look very, very different in terms of the choices that we make. It is a very carefully written, thoroughly researched book. And the co-author I'm speaking with today, Joshua Goldstein, is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University and the author of a number of previous books. Again, this book published by Public Affairs is titled A Bright Future: How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Joshua Goldstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's great to be with you.
I really appreciated the foreword of the book by Steven Pinker, whom I have interviewed on this program before. At one point in talking about your book, he says, A Bright Future, the title of your book, is climate change for grown-ups. I know those are Steven Pinker's words and not yours, but I have a feeling you know exactly what he's talking about. Let's begin there. In what way is this book a book about this topic for grown-ups in a way that is in contrast to much of the rest of what is written about climate change?
Well, a lot of the discussion about climate change, which has been picking up lately, that's good. There's a lot of concern about the topic, but a lot of it is fragmented. People are talking about ideological things, like if Al Gore's against it, then I'm for it, or vice versa. So there's a whole divisive politics overlaid on the problem. And in terms of solutions, people are fragmented in their approach, like if we build wind and solar panels, that'll be good, or if we sequester carbon, that'll be good, or if I become a vegetarian, that's what everybody should do. And what we need that's missing, and I hope this book contributes to it, is an overview, big picture perspective on the problem. What do we really need to do to solve the problem of climate change? That's how I got into the topic. I'm a world trends global affairs professor, and I was an environmentalist, California hippie kind of personality, and I didn't like nuclear power. But I had a son who, when he became about 10 years old, became a climate activist. And about 5 years ago, when he was about 20, he said everybody should drop everything and work on climate change. It's that important. And I agreed with him. So I started looking into what would it actually take to solve the problem. And I was surprised to find that when you do the math, we're not on track. Most of the proposed solutions wouldn't actually get us to where we need to be. And that you actually can't get to the solution without a big dose of nuclear power.
Right.
And then I found my Stefan Kvist, the Swedish engineer who was writing about how Sweden had done this already. And that's how I hooked up with him and we wrote the book.
And we'll get into many of those specifics as we proceed. One of the things that you do that I think is helpful and interesting in helping us really grapple with the whole notion of climate change on a different level is when you split the notion of climate change into two levels. And the one is what tends to be talked about the most because it's the kind of thing that makes the headlines and it's the kind of thing you can show graphic video footage of. And then there is sort of the next step of climate change, which is potentially far more catastrophic. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about in terms of these two different kinds of climate change and how we sometimes focus so much on the one that we neglect the other, which is even more important in terms of the survival of our planet and the human race.
Yeah, it's natural to focus on big dramatic things that are happening right now. And those are the hurricanes and the fires, the droughts. So a lot of people say climate change is here. You know, we see it now. It's already arrived. And that's not really accurate because although we have more hurricanes and fires and droughts, those are things we can live with, honestly. It's just a kind of statistical matter of having more of that going on. But that's what's happening now. The problem is that the things that we do now about climate change will play out for decades and even centuries in the future. We may be dead before they actually happen, but we may set in motion processes that then can't be stopped and that are just catastrophic for the future of the planet. And as an example, I live in New England, and 12,000 years ago, this place that I'm in was covered with a mile-thick sheet of ice. It's not that long ago on a geological scale. And there are climate scenarios where the Atlantic conveyor belt, so-called, shuts down because of melting ice in Greenland, and you could trigger another ice age. That kind of thing, the massive extinctions of species, the big sea level rise, 12 feet, 200 feet, you know, things that are just game over for large parts of the world. Now, those are not here now, and they will take time to arrive. But the decisions we make in the next 10 to 30 years are going to determine whether those kinds of outcomes happen.
Hmm.
So I liken it to an asteroid is heading for the Earth, and we would all mobilize so that it doesn't hit us, and we shoot rockets out there to nudge it off course and so forth. But what if it wasn't going to hit for 30 to 50 years? Then it still would be the best time to get out there and nudge it off course while it was still far enough away.
Right.
But we wouldn't have that urgency to it.
Right. Of course, one of the things that maybe curbs our sense of urgency about this is the fact that there is not perfect unanimity in the science community when it comes to these kind of predictions. That is, what is sort of the scale of catastrophe that we are facing here, or what sort of trigger points might occur? I mean, you spell this out yourself in your book, that scientists are not in perfect agreement when it comes to this. I wonder if you could just say a word about that, that lack of agreement. Is it, in a sense, inherently impossible for scientists to come to agreement when we're talking about that kind of science that is looking to the far future, or maybe the not so far future? And also, how do you suggest that we treat this matter, given the fact that before this there have been scientists who made doomsday predictions that have not in fact come to pass as they predicted? How do we handle this whole matter of predictive science when it comes to this matter, which is very much a matter of life and death for our whole planet?
I think the scientists are in pretty good agreement about it, and they're actually pretty conservative. I've been watching this for 30 years now, and what used to be the worst-case scenarios are now kind of the normal, expected, middle-of-the-road scenarios, because scientists don't want to stick their neck out too far beyond the facts and data that they have. The problem is more basic than that, and it is that climate is very complex, and the best modeling you can do is imperfect, and we don't have any historical experience to say what these changes really would look like or what timescale they might play out on. Everyone agrees that putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is warming up the Earth, and we can measure how much of it there is, and we can measure how much the Earth is warming, but that triggers complicated and uncertain effects off in the future that, you know, we just don't know for sure. So it's a big gamble. The question is, do you want to do the things now that are the most economical and convenient, that are big gambles on catastrophic outcomes for our children and grandchildren? Or do you want to do something that's more inconvenient and expensive now in order to improve the chances of leaving a good world for our children and grandchildren? So that's a hard calculation, because there's a lot of uncertainty in it. But I think clearly the responsible thing to do is to try to get on top of the problem as soon as we can and as vigorously as we can, and to try to do it in a way that minimizes the expense and inconvenience of solving it. So if the answer is everybody has to stop using electricity and stop driving and become vegetarians, that's not a very practical solution, because people will say, you know, that's a big hit to take right now for something off in the future that's still uncertain. But if we say there's a solution, as we try to outline in this book, that won't cost more and will actually be convenient and affordable, then that's a good solution and people will adopt it. Much easier to get people to adopt cheaper electricity than to get them to adopt more expensive electricity.
Mm. And, of course, part of the point that your book makes is that we need to think about the planet that we are leaving for our children and for our grandchildren. And if we are not willing to undertake certain moves now, then we are making all but certain a very bleak future for the generations who come after us. Unfortunately, as your book points out, climate change, this is what you write, climate change, unfortunately, has become a partisan issue in the United States. And I really like the way you kind of spell this out, how on both sides of this, there is politicization going on that is really not helpful. in terms of getting us all together around what you call a narrative of common purpose. I want you to just spell out, if you would, the way in which people on both sides of this divide in the United States over climate change have made it, in a sense, more political than it is helpful for it to be.
Yeah, let me imagine that you go to the doctor and discover you have a life-threatening disease, but there's a proven medicine that can cure it. And then your options are to say, oh, I'm going to go into denial, I don't have any disease. Or you could say, I'm going to take some other medicine that's unproven and has never worked. Or you can say, I'm doomed, I'm going to die, and freeze up. But what we say is, how about take the medicine that's proven? Now, what's this mean for climate change? You've got the deniers who say there is no climate change. You've got the environmentalist group saying we'll do 100% renewables, which can't really work, but we like it. And then you've got most of the population just kind of frozen up, not knowing what to do, and feeling like we're going to die. So we're talking about coming up with the medicine that's proven to work.
Mm.
What we actually have in the political debate now, though, is overlaid on trying to solve the problem is trying to score political points on the other party. And right now, the best predictor of how someone feels about climate change is not how much they know about it or where they live or how old they are. It's what political party they belong to. And that's just a terrible way to come at the problem, because climate doesn't know if you're a Democrat or a Republican.
Right. And you spell...
And, you know, neither Democrats nor Republicans care more or less about their grandchildren. I can tell you that for sure. But the hopeful thing is that if you stop talking about climate change and Al Gore and all that, and you talk about the solutions, clean energy, wind power, nuclear power, renewables, and various solutions to the problem, then there's a lot of bipartisan agreement. And, for instance, Sam Brown back out in Kansas recently, governor there, very conservative Republican, loved wind power because Kansas had a lot of wind. It was good for the economy. And Texas loves wind power. And the U.S. Congress just passed a big bill with huge bipartisan support for nuclear power innovation and modernization. It's on President Trump's desk right now. The very liberal senators like Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island supported it, as did the very conservative like Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma. So when you talk about solutions, you have a lot of agreement across party lines. But when you talk about the rhetoric and the ideology of it, then it all breaks down into party politics.
Right. You spell out something that is apparently based on a quote from environmentalist George Marshall, who apparently said, climate change calls for a narrative of common purpose. Humans need to rise to the challenge of climate change together. But people are more motivated by an enemy narrative. And of course, as long as people in our current divisive political climate gravitate towards that enemy narrative, with climate change not being the enemy, but other entities being the enemy that we have to kind of deal with or resent or be suspicious of, that is going to make solving this here in the United States all the more difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Joshua S. Goldstein, who is the co-author of a very intriguing book called A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. So you have chosen, you and your co-author, to focus on a specific facet of the whole matter of climate change, namely... electricity generation, where we get our electricity from, and the ways in which that needs to dramatically change. Explain, first of all, why you and your co-author chose to focus on this facet of the problem. Is it because it's the single most important facet of the problem, or because it is one that lends itself for whatever reason to a single book of fairly modest dimensions, or just exactly why is this the point on which you focus so clearly in your book?
Two reasons. One, it's the place where you can get the most traction the most quickly, because the largest contributor to carbon emissions, CO2 going into the atmosphere, is from electric power generation, from coal in particular. And half of that coal's in China, so it's a very, if you want it, the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. Switching off coal for a clean power source is the fastest way to begin to reduce carbon going into the atmosphere. The second reason is a little bit bigger than that, and it involves some math that basically is the total world energy use now coming 85% from fossil fuels. And by mid-century, these climate scientists tell us that we want to get rid of those fossil fuels, which is just a huge undertaking in a small period of time. So switching over the grid that we have now is one thing, but there's transportation and industry and building heating that are also running on fossil fuels, and we have to switch them over to something clean. And in most cases, that's going to involve electrification. It could be electric vehicles. It could be using cheap electric power to produce alternate fuels like ammonia instead of diesel fuel, for instance. Or it could be electrifying steel production, heating with electric air source heat pumps instead of heating oil. So when you start to switch those things over, it just multiplies the amount of clean electricity that you need. Switching over today's grid is one thing, but we may, by mid-century, need 4 times as much electricity as we have now as we switch these things over. And so you just need a vast amounts of clean electricity. And there's nothing that scales up as fast as nuclear power because it's so concentrated. A pound of coal, if you turn it into electricity, it'll run an American house for about 30 minutes worth of electricity. But if you turn a pound of uranium into electricity, it'll run that house for 2 years. Hmm. It's just a million times more concentrated and potent than coal. And in contrast, the renewables, which are great as far as they go, sun and wind and all, but they're less concentrated, so they're slower to scale up. And a country like Germany that has tried really hard to put in wind and solar, put a tremendous effort into it in the last decade, and has put in a fair amount, but the rate at which they've added clean energy is 1/5 of what Sweden and France did when they added nuclear power. So to put it another way, what Sweden and France's rate could do in 30 years, decarbonizing the whole world, would take 150 years the way Germany does it with renewables.
Mm.
So there's two issues. One is scale and just how much electricity is really needed. Really taking a hard look at that and not just figuring that if you throw in some clean electricity into the mix, you'll be okay. You won't. And then the second is speed. How fast can you get clean energy into the system?
Hmm.
And we really need to do it fast.
Right. And, of course, this is all built around this notion of decarbonization. That is the process by which we can shift off of our dependence on fossil fuels. I was really surprised to read in your book that in the 21st century, the fastest growing energy source in the world is coal. And it sounds like a big factor in that is the need, the escalating need for electricity that we find in poorer countries around the world. Explain the connection between that. First of all, that phenomenon of so much of the world, of the poorer countries of the world, having escalating needs for electricity, and why coal is the answer for them, at least in the short term.
If you look at a graph of the generating fuels that go into the world's electricity, it's just striking that coal is up at the top and it's grown so fast. And then when you dig into it, it's China that dominates that. China was behind the United States in carbon emissions just at the beginning of this century, you know, less than two decades ago. And then just in the last 15 years or so, it's shot up. And now China's CO2 emissions are above the United States and the European Union combined. They're just really the big issue and right now. That's number one. And a lot of that is coal. That's their dominant source, primarily generating electricity from coal. And then behind China, looking a little further into the future, is a tier of poor, large, developing countries, sort of poor, but sort of coming along and beginning to get their feet under them, like India, Indonesia, these very large countries with voracious demand for energy. And like, you know, India, the demand for air conditioning alone is just vast in terms of how much electricity we'll need to add to the grid to satisfy that demand. And it's a good thing because energy in poor countries brings people out of poverty. And as happened in China, you know, hundreds of millions of people rising out of poverty. We want that to happen in India and Indonesia and these other countries as well. We want people to have air conditioning because it's really hot and it's bad for their health, and air conditioning is a good thing. So how do we meet the demand for this huge rise in electricity use in these poorer countries? And right now, the cheapest, easiest, most practical way to do that is with coal. And, you know, it's a hard truth that coal has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty at the same time that it's destroying the planet through climate change. So the point is that if you want to stop climate change, you cannot just tell poor countries that they have to stop growing, that they can't have air conditioners, that they can't burn coal and need to do something more expensive. You need to provide a better alternative, something that's as practical as coal, something that's as cheap or cheaper than coal. And then people, then tell them to use it. But don't tell them that we've used up all the carbon that the world can handle while we got rich, and now they have to stay poor as a result. That's not moral.
So much of your book is based upon what was done in the nation of Sweden. And you point to a two-decade period from 1970 to 1990 in which the nation of Sweden was able to cut its total carbon emissions by half and its emission per person by more than 60%. And then you tell us in the same paragraph, at the same time, Sweden's economy expanded by 50% and its electricity generation more than doubled. And you spell out the story of how that was done through a power source that most of us have not heard of, at least the way they talk about it in Sweden, Kärnkraft. Explain, first of all, why Sweden went to this energy source called Kärnkraft. What was motivating that shift? And tell us more about the dramatic difference that it made.
Yeah, so Sweden had a lot of hydropower because they've got rivers in the north that are dammed. And then that's like 40% of their electric generation. But the rest was fossil fuel, and especially imported oil and gas. So this had nothing to do with climate change. It was before those concerns arose. What they were concerned about was the oil embargoes from the Middle East in the 1970s. And so it was energy security and also basic economics, because the imported fossil fuels were expensive. So they went to this Kärnkraft energy source, which was so, and just the punchline here is that that's just Swedish for nuclear power. But we describe it in the book as Kärnkraft. So because when you say nuclear power, people think nuclear, and they get confused with nuclear weapons and they freak out. So if you can step back, call it by its Swedish name for a minute, and just think about its advantages. It's so concentrated. It was so affordable. It's carbon-free, pollution-free, and fast to put in. You know, just in that short time period, they cut their carbon so fast, their economy grew. They have among the cheapest electricity in Europe. So does France, which is also highly reliant on nuclear power, whatever the French for that is. And their lifestyle did not suffer. You know, Sweden is not sitting around shivering in the dark because they're saving so much energy. They have among the highest energy use per capita of any country. So, and this is an important point in the book, that the whole way of framing climate change, that we have to make sacrifices and bear terrible burdens for the sake of future generations, we don't think that's the right way to think about it. Now, Sweden did this, and they're a happy, prosperous country with lots of energy, affordable electricity, industry's done well, and we think that's the model for the world. Now, have your cake and eat it, too. Have clean electricity and affordable electricity. Good for the economy, good for the environment. It shouldn't be a conflict.
In other words, the bottom line here is that we need more energy, not less. And that
That's
energy
right.
needs to be clean.
That's right.
That is the heart of the matter. And this is how Sweden went about it, using this energy source called Kernkraft, which not until the end of the chapter do you tell us or explain, is actually the Swedish term for nuclear power. I love the way you explain that, and I feel badly for our listeners who in a sense have had that surprise ruined by our conversation. But for others who read your book without knowing exactly where it's going, it's an interesting little surprise. By contrast, and we've already touched on this briefly, the nation of Germany has handled some of these questions actually quite differently, although at a vague, sloppy glance, it might seem like they are sort of on the same bandwagon. In fact, Germany made different choices with very significant consequences. Explain what Germany's priorities have been when it comes to the matter of where their energy comes from.
Germany's been following a policy they call energy transition, and their policy is to build up renewables as fast as they can, wind and solar, but at the same time to phase out nuclear power, because especially after the Fukushima accident, they freaked out about nuclear power, and there's been a very lively environmentalist movement against nuclear power in Germany, kind of drawing strength from the Cold War, Germany being in the heart of the Cold War standoff and nuclear weapons being part of that. People wrongly associate the weapons with the power. There's been a public outcry against nuclear power for quite some time, and the Green Party has been gaining strength and joining the government in Germany. So the policy is phase out nuclear power, put in renewables, and they've been doing this very vigorously for a decade. The problem with the policy is that both of those are carbon-free sources. And as fast as they put in renewables, they're taking away nuclear power. So it doesn't really touch the fossil fuel part of the German economy, which is on their electric grid, it's 40% coal. And most of that is lignite, which is a particularly dirty, polluting, carbon-heavy form of coal. So they're running in circles, you know, running on a treadmill, so to speak. Taking away one clean energy source, putting in another clean energy source, and meanwhile burning the same amount of coal as ever. And so when you look at the outcome of all this in terms of Germany's CO2 emissions, they haven't really gone down at all. And, you know, it's this very strong contrast to what Sweden did when they used nuclear power, where the carbon emissions went down quite rapidly. The result is that the GDP per capita in Germany and Sweden are about the same. They're both prosperous Northern European countries, very similar economically. But when you look at the carbon emissions, Germany's are twice as large as Sweden's.
Hmm.
So Germany talks the talk, but Sweden walks the walk.
In this chapter about Germany, you certainly spend some time talking about renewables And you certainly see a role in renewables like wind and solar power, but you believe that they cannot be, in a sense, the heart and soul of the solution. And when you spell out some of the issues of wind power and solar power, one of the things that you talk about is how they are inherently diffuse in contrast to concentrated energy sources. Explain what the difference is. What is diffuse about wind and solar power, and why is it preferable to have a concentrated energy source instead?
Well, the sun, there's a lot of sunshine and a lot of wind out there, but to capture them, there's only a little bit on any particular spot. And so you need to put in large-scale solar farms in order to get electricity from that, in contrast to coal and even more contrast to nuclear power. As I mentioned, nuclear power is a million times more concentrated than coal, and coal is much more concentrated than sunshine. I give you an example. In Ontario province in Canada, they've gotten off of coal primarily by using nuclear power. That's been a big success story. And recently they tore down one of their last coal plants, and on the site they put in a solar farm. So people said, oh, look, solar is replacing coal. But the actual output of that solar farm is a fraction of 1% of what the coal plant was producing. So that's the sense in which it's less concentrated. Now, solar panels are getting really cheap, and there's a new generation of what's called organic solar cells that can be rolled out like on flexible sheets of plastic and stuff like that. So could be very, very cheap. And there are places where that could be a pretty important contribution in deserts, and especially when you can use the sun when it shines to produce liquid fuels that are alternatives to gasoline and that kind of thing. But inherently, the idea of entirely powering the grid with solar and wind, it's not so much that they're not concentrated. That's true. And, you know, you're going to take a lot of farmland and forest and cover it over with solar cells if you want to power things with solar. But you could do that. The bigger problem is that the sun goes down every night, and then there's no way to store the electricity. And you're not going to turn off all the lights at night. That's when you want them. So until we have some practical way to store energy, and there's really none in the foreseeable future, nothing on the horizon, then you need some what's called baseload power, something that will continue to generate regardless of the weather, regardless if it's day or night, regardless if it's winter and the sun's low in the sky. And so far that's been coal or natural gas.
Right.
But it's also nuclear power.
So you write at one point this phrase or the slogan that is often heard in certain quarters of 100% renewables as a laudable goal. You write 100% renewables is a slogan that distracts from the work at hand, which is the decarbonization of the world. In other words, the notion of depending entirely on renewables is apt to prevent us from reaching what is a far more important goal, namely the decarbonization of our planet. That's what needs to happen.
Yeah, we're not against the renewables. In fact, we think like Sweden has hydropower and nuclear power, and they work together. Hydroelectric, wind, solar all have a contribution to make. They're all good. They move in the right direction. What we really object to is this idea of 100% renewables, that you can do the whole thing with just renewables. And that's impractical. Mm. It's not going to work. And most of the experts who know anything about it will tell you that's just not in the cards. When it's 5 or 10% of the grid, then the renewables have a great contribution. The more you put on, the harder it is to do because of the intermittency.
Right.
We found that in Europe as a whole, there was an entire week out of the year when neither wind nor solar were producing. So what are you going to do for that week? Either you need a whole fossil fuel backup system, or you need tremendously overbuilt capacity, or you need something like nuclear power to back that up.
We're speaking with Joshua Goldstein, co-author of A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. So much of your book spells out the case for nuclear energy and the fact that nuclear energy is something that, many of us, in a sense, badly misunderstand at the moment. And in particular, in a section of the book called Facing Fears, you try to take apart some of the most significant concerns that surround nuclear energy. And of course, many of those concerns very much heightened by the disaster that occurred in 2011 in Japan with a massive earthquake and then tsunami that ended up causing severe damage to the Onagawa nuclear power plant. How has the world, generally speaking, misunderstood that disaster? In what ways has the world, in your view, taken away the wrong lessons from what occurred in Japan?
So first of all, the Onagawa plant was not the one that had all the attention. It was closer to the epicenter of the earthquake.
Oh, yes, Fukushima.
But Onagawa had a high seawall, and it had some flooding. The people from the village there actually took refuge in the nuclear power plant to be safe and secure, and nothing went, you know, plant shut down normally, and nothing went wrong. But in the Fukushima plant, all their backup generators were located in a low-lying area, and the seawall wasn't high enough, and it all got flooded. So it wasn't actually the nuclear plant. It was the design of the site and the backup generators that went wrong. But the result was an accident at the plant that ended up building up hydrogen gas that exploded very dramatically and released some radiation. And then everybody freaked out, and they evacuated hundreds of thousands of people. They ripped patients from hospitals without any medical attendance and put them on buses, and it was just crazy. The actual accident at the plant, so let me back up, the earthquake and tsunami, this was the fourth largest earthquake in recorded history, just an epic natural disaster, and it killed something like 18,000 people. The actual accident at Fukushima didn't kill anybody. The radiation that leaked out was never above the levels that are considered safe for occupational or medical applications. You know, like if you're working as a medical technician or working in a nuclear power plant, there's a certain level of radiation you're supposed to stay below. The public was never exposed to higher levels than that. And yet there's this massive panicky evacuation that did cause some people to die from that. But, you know, we look back at this epic disaster, and the thing that people remember is the Fukushima nuclear disaster. And there wasn't any disaster at Fukushima. There was a big natural disaster. Part of the problem with nuclear power is that we all in the culture crosswire real or imagined disasters and put them onto real nuclear power situations. The prime example of that was the Three Mile Island accident, which really amounted to nothing. It was expensive. It was an industrial accident that put the plant out of operations. That's a big, expensive piece of machinery you can't use. But nobody was hurt by it. And yet it happened at the very time that a major motion picture, The China Syndrome with Jane Fonda, was in the theaters, and everybody figured that what they were seeing in the movie was what was happening in Pennsylvania at Three Mile Island. It wasn't. But we crosswire them. And most fundamentally, we crosswire nuclear weapons with nuclear power. They both came out of the same era. They're invented at similar times. And especially those of us that grew up during the Cold War and put our heads under the desks to get ready for a nuclear attack, we're traumatized. We're terrorized by it. And we don't, in that terrorized state of mind, think very clearly about the differences between a nuclear power plant and a nuclear weapon. A power plant cannot blow up like a nuclear bomb. It's just not possible. And it's been in 60 years that we've had nuclear power, it's been by far the safest source of energy that we have. 400 times safer than coal in terms of how many people die per kilowatt hour of electric production.
Right.
You know, 400 times safer, and yet everybody's worried about the tiny little things, little bits of radiation that are actually harmless. And coal, meanwhile, kills like a million people a year from all the smoke and causes emphysema and cancer and all that. We don't pay enough attention to coal risks, and we pay too much attention to nuclear risks. We don't pay enough attention to climate change. We pay too much attention to, you know, the possibility that some little thing may go wrong with a nuclear power plant.
Right. What you're pointing to is what you say is a record that shows nuclear power to be far cleaner and far safer than energy produced by coal. At one point in the book, you say the world seems to have lost a can-do attitude toward nuclear power that met great success in earlier decades. How would you have us restore that can-do attitude about finding ways to make nuclear power work and be the ultimate solution for the problem of climate change?
We need to get over basing our policy on fear, and we need to really think clearly and pull together the resources that we need, the political capital, the financial capital, and the technological know-how, and put together a project that would make it the goal to produce lots of nuclear reactors, one after the other, the way we crank out Boeing jetliners from an assembly line, and not do them one by one here and there, bit by bit. Our big trouble recently in the United States is we didn't build any reactors for 30 years, and then we came along and tried to build new designs that had never been done before. And then we changed the designs and the safety regulations after the construction had already started, and you end up with just huge overruns of cost, and it was a fiasco, and a couple of them had to be canceled after spending billions of dollars on them. What you want to do is the opposite of that. You want to settle on one design, build it repeatedly. This is what Sweden and France and South Korea have done successfully. And build it repeatedly, ultimately in a central location, a factory or a shipyard, instead of each one on its own site-specific kind of construction design. And crank them out from these factories and shipyards, send them out to where they're needed, and bring the costs down substantially. South Korea can already produce nuclear reactors at nuclear power cheaper than coal and cheaper than fossil fuels. But we can do better than that with this repeated build, mass production, centralized facility. And, you know, imagine coming down to 1 cent per kilowatt hour, for instance. You know, my electric bill is 20 cents, but natural gas can produce electric power now in the United States for 3 cents, 3 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour. Nothing goes below 2 cents. And if you can go below 2 cents a kilowatt hour, then that's a technology that will be adopted by places like India, Indonesia, that currently have nothing cheaper than coal. You say, here's something cheaper than coal, they'll use it. So that's a way to scale it up really fast. But it's not going to happen by itself. It needs a concerted effort, some political will, some financial capital behind it.
Well, your book is certainly an important contribution to a conversation, of course, that is happening in various ways across the globe. The book, again, is A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow, published by Public Affairs. And the co-authors, Stefanie Quist, and my morning show guest today, Joshua Goldstein. Professor Goldstein, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule to have this conversation about your fascinating book. Best wishes.
Thanks. It's been good to be with you. There's a website if people want more info at brightfuturebook.com. Have a good day.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to welcoming back into our studios Gwida Brown, Executive Director of the Hope Council. We'll be talking about alcohol abuse specifically, and also about some proposed changes in drunk driving laws here in the state of Wisconsin, which still has the dubious distinction of being one of the